Hello and welcome to the Counting the Earth podcast from the UK Centre for Ecology and Hydrology. I'm Sue Nelson.
And I'm Alice Hope. Throughout this podcast, we explore the environment and the natural world, but always through the lens of one number.
And today's number is 1,000, because in this episode, we're discussing so-called forever chemicals, and our number, 1,000, is the estimated number of years they will take to break down in the environment.
Today's episode features UKCEH's labs and freezers in Lancaster, where we discover how buzzards, kestrels, and other birds of prey are helping scientists and the government track the spread of these chemicals in the environment. And we should warn listeners, if you're slightly squeamish, that there is the discussion of a post-mortem on birds in this episode.
But first, let's just set out the basics, because there are a lot of long chemical names and acronyms bandied about with this topic. So let's start with some definitions of those forever chemicals.
Well, the first acronym you need to know is PFAS, or PFAS, and that stands for per- and polyfluorinated alkyl substances. I'm amazed I managed to say that right. This is a family of around 10,000 synthetic chemicals, the so-called forever chemicals, some of which have been widely used since around the mid-20th century. Now, they have really useful properties. They're extremely stable and can repel oil or grease or water, so they're used globally for water and weatherproofing or stain repellents. You can find them in a wide range of products, from paints, non-stick kitchenware, takeaway food boxes, cosmetics, firefighting foams, the list just goes on and on.
All very useful, of course, but, and there is a but, the problem is that these chemicals get into the environment in a lot of different ways. In some cases, such as with firefighting foams, these chemicals are deliberately released into the environment in order to damp down blazes and save lives. When used in household products, those chemicals are released through wear and tear during normal use over time, collecting in dust, getting washed down the drain, and so accumulating in our homes and the natural world, where they stay. And this is the forever part. That stability that makes them so useful also means they don't break down easily when they get into the environment. So when they get into soils and water, they get taken up by plants, ingested by animals, and because they don't break down even inside the body, they keep cycling around and accumulating up the food chain, what is known as bioaccumulation.
These chemicals have been found throughout terrestrial, freshwater, and marine habitats across the globe, as well as inside numerous animal species, including in human blood samples. So there is worldwide concern about potential adverse effects from PFAS use on human health and the environment.
There is indeed. And there's the potential impact of these chemicals as they accumulate in our bodies and the environment. And that's been what has struck me the most while we were making this episode.
Some European nations are so worried, they're proposing a wide-scale ban. The use of two older forever chemicals is already heavily restricted or banned under the Stockholm Convention. PFOs, which is perfluorooctane sulfonate, and PFOA, which is perfluorooctanoic acid, the latter featuring in the movie Dark Waters starring Mark Ruffalo, is already quite well known. Both chemicals have been linked to problems with how the body processes fats and how it regulates hormones. Both are part of the PFAS family, but most are still in use, and if one gets banned, there are thousands of others to choose from.
A good summary to begin with, but let's quickly discuss the 1,000-year figure and the phrase forever chemicals, because both are a bit of a catch-all term, aren't they?
Well, yes. We picked that figure because these chemicals are widely referred to as forever chemicals, and the estimates often used are that they could persist in the environment for as long as 1,000 years. But in reality, we don't really know. A quick tour of the internet and you get a range of suggested lifespans, and of course, different chemicals within this group will have different properties and therefore different lifespans. Some may last decades, some way, way longer. These chemicals have only been around since the 1930s, and we're still finding out how long they can persist.
Now, as you said, Alice, there's a lot of concern about the ubiquitous contamination by these chemicals. So we wanted to explore how they're being monitored. And this led us to a huge extremely cold walk-in freezer. It's the start of our tour around ecotoxicologist Lee Walker's predatory bird monitoring scheme at UKCH Lancaster. It's a long-term national monitoring scheme aimed at tracking chemical pollutants in the environment and their effects.
I've got some extra clothing for you now to keep you warm while we're in the freezer.
Oh, that is a very thick coat.
Make sure you zip it up and keep warm.
Yep, nice and wrapped up warm.
Mine on as well. Okay, where are we headed?
This is where we store the birds for the predatory bird monitoring scheme until we've got the opportunity to carry out the post-mortem examination on the birds.
Okay, lead the way.
Right, this is a big heavy door. Move yourselves. If you'd like to follow me through the curtain.
Oh, wow, that's cold.
That is very, very chilly. What temperature is it in here?
It's minus 18, so it's like being in your domestic chest freezer.
Not something either of us, I think, would do under normal circumstances.
No, I would not choose to be this cold under any other circumstance, I don't think.
You've got quite a collection of boxes here, some polystyrene, some looking like small pizza boxes.
What do we have in here?
Each bird is stored in its own bag, which we label with an identification number.
And what's that one? Is that Buzz, or am I just reading something?
So that's Buzz, short for buzzard.
And what other species do we have in here?
A big variety. We'll receive any of the native species of predatory bird that we have in the UK. Receive a few each year of the rarer species, like merlin and ospreys, but we mostly receive the more common species like the buzzard, barn owl, sparrowhawk.
I can see a sample there with some rather beautiful feathers,
yes,
brown and black. Do you mind if we have a look? And what type of bird is that?
So this is a kestrel, a common kestrel. And they are so beautiful. Their wings have these barred markings on them, and they just look so beautiful.
It's just a shame that we're so close to them and they're dead, isn't
yes.
it? But they were handed to you by members of the public. They found these dead birds.
Yeah, people are very engaged with these species, and there's a bit of ownership as well. Sometimes we'll get a call from someone who says, I found this bird, I think it's the one that used to frequent my garden, things like that. People put the time and effort in to submit birds to us. It's a real privilege to work with the public like that.
And roughly how many samples do you have in here at the moment?
Oof, goodness me. I'd say there's about 150 here at the moment. On a typical year, we receive between 400 and 600 birds a year from a range of species.
Do you know what? I think it's snowing.
I swear it's snowing in here.
It's from the condenser, yeah. There's a little water got in it, so it's produced. It's like a snow machine, yeah?
And why do you focus on birds when it comes to these so-called forever chemicals?
Predatory birds are a bit like a canary. That doesn't sound right, does it? But they are, because they tell us about the wider environment. And one of the things that reasons why they do so is because they're at the top of the food chain, so they're apex predators. What that means is chemicals that we're concerned about, they tend to accumulate as they pass up through the food chain, so you'll see higher concentrations at the higher levels of the food chain. And being at the top, you're most likely to see concentrations of those chemicals of concern in those predatory birds.
And that matters for the forever chemicals, doesn't it? Because they last such a long time. I mean, 1,000 years is the headline figure for this episode. And do these birds sort of act as a way of understanding where they are in the environment?
Yeah, so different species will inhabit different parts of the environment. So if a species that's more associated with an aquatic environment and you're seeing higher levels in that species, then that suggests that those chemicals are moving into and being retained within the aquatic environment. But we've got all different birds that have different diets as well, so that can tell you about different parts of the food chain within the same aquatic or terrestrial environment. Now I'm going to take you into our Predatory Bird Monitoring Scheme archive.
And it just looks like a very humble porter cabin.
It's just a really big freezer.
Okay, another one.
Another big freezer with another heavy door. Go through the curtain again.
We know the routine now, don't we?
So through the curtain.
Ooh, that onslaught of cold air.
It's not snowing in here, though, so that is a positive.
Wow. Now, this really does look like the back of a shoe shop, but a shoe shop being very sort of flattened cardboard boxes.
We estimate that it's around about 100,000 samples that we have in here.
And how far back do these samples date? Sort of what age are we talking?
We have some samples here from the late 1960s. And so this archive is effectively coming up to its 60th birthday.
That's incredible. Such a humble looking place, yet so scientifically important.
Exactly. What this archive allows us to do is to carry out retrospective studies, like looking back in time using the archive. Because sometimes when concerns rise regarding a particular chemical, it's already been in use for a number of years. And so what we can do with these samples is take them from a timeline till before the chemicals were being used up to current day, and so we can reconstruct the timeline of exposure within the birds.
And what kind of samples have we got here? What do they contain?
In these boxes here, we have a range of different tissues, some soft tissues like muscle, brain, kidney, liver. Liver is a very important one for studying chemicals. We also have sort of harder samples like bone, feather, and we actually do store the whole wings of birds as well.
Now, I know they're mostly birds, but I've just seen a couple behind you, boxes saying otter.
Yeah, that's right. We actually collaborate with a number of other monitoring schemes, including the Cardiff University Otter Project. We have our different expertise and analytical capabilities, and so sometimes we'll share samples to allow us to do the studies that we need to do on that particular species.
And does that give you a sort of better holistic understanding of what's going on throughout levels of the food chain and also different parts of the environment as well?
Exactly, yeah. So we all work within a network called the WildComms network that UKCEH run. That network is also contributing to nationwide monitoring of chemicals for the 25-year environment improvement plan. There we draw upon the terrestrial, aquatic and marine environment, and there's all expertise with sister projects that carry out similar work as the PBMS, but the PBMS was the first one. So.
Now look, I hate to be the killjoy here, but it feels much, much colder than that first freezer, and my fingers, I think, are going blue. I think we're going to have to go out.
Yeah, okay. I can't feel my nose.
No, right, let's go. I'm okay. Sorry, let's get out
let's
right
get
now.
Back out.
Oh my goodness.
Thank you to Lee Walker and his fascinating archive of Birds of Prey. Now, we should say here that whilst in the past the scheme has accepted birds from members of the public, currently they are only accepting birds from wildlife professionals due to the recent avian flu outbreak. But to find out more about this amazing scheme, please do go to their website and we will put a link in the episode description.
We'll return to Lee in Lancaster shortly to see what they do with the samples once they've taken them from the birds. And I'm very happy to say that it will be a lot warmer in that lab, won't it, Alice?
Yes, a lot warmer. I've never been that cold before, and we were so wrapped up and it was still freezing. I mean, we couldn't be in there for very long.
Yeah, in fact, I think at one point I was actually in pain because my fingers were so cold having to hold the microphone. I think it was one of those interviews where we suffered for our science in getting to learn about environmental science.
Yes, it was very, very interesting. And it was such a privilege to be able to see those birds so up close. I mean, they were absolutely beautiful. The markings, the stripes, the spots, things that you just wouldn't see when you see them flying past you at quite some distance.
Absolutely. And being snowed on in that freezer reminded me of a startling piece of research I read about 2 years ago, that rainwater in almost every location on Earth contains levels of these chemicals that would be judged unsafe to drink, including in Antarctica. So not only are they in the soil and accumulating at the food chain when animals eat lesser prey, like Lee's predatory birds, They are so common that they're circulating around the atmosphere in rainwater. So in other words, there is literally no space on Earth to avoid these substances.
Gosh, that's a really sobering thought, isn't it? We think of Antarctica as this
pristine
landscape, and even there you find these chemicals, which is why monitoring is so important and why we're returning to Lancaster and the second half of our tour through the predatory bird monitoring scheme. Right, rubber gloves on. Where are we now, Lee?
We're in the post-mortem examination room now. What we've got here is a biological safety cabinet, because the birds we get in, they can be of various levels of decomposition. So to protect ourselves, we have a biological safety cabinet to do the work on.
And you've got a sample similar to the bag that we saw in the freezer. What sample is this? It looks quite a big one.
Yeah, it's a buzzard, a common buzzard. So this is one of the larger species that we have in the UK, certainly within the lowland areas. You get some larger eagles and species like that, but of the lowland species, the buzzard's one of the biggest.
Talk us through then what you're about to do.
We're going to take a range of observations. The primary reason for carrying out the examination is to take tissue samples, which we then store in our tissue archive. But as well as that, we also carry out observations to help us to age and sex the bird and to assess whether the bird's in a starved state or not. All those factors can affect the amount of contaminants that they accumulate and we can measure in their tissues.
Do we know anything about this bird other than that it's a buzzard? Do we know when it was collected or where from?
Well, many buzzards, I think like this one, is sent in to us because it's been hit by a car. I'm just going to open up and I'll have a look at the bird and see what I can tell from that.
Gosh, that is big, isn't it? That's about... I know I kept using a shoebox reference with the samples, but that is the length of a shoebox. That's a large bird.
Yeah, but not as large as it could be, because feeling its keel, its breastbone, is quite exposed, so that means it's in a starved state. It's a bit wet, so it's probably been out by the side of the road a bit, quite a while. But
you're stretching the wings there.
Yeah,
what? This is incredible to see up.
I've never seen one this close up before.
Oh my goodness, those wings are about twice the length of your hand, aren't they?
Yeah.
The feathers, each individual feather.
So you can imagine when it's soaring.
Wow, that's about a metre. You're holding it across and that's about a metre. Mm.
They have such big wings so they can soar using relatively little energy.
I can't help noticing its head's missing.
Yeah. That is likely to have been because it was hit by a car and perhaps scavenged a little as well by something like a fox or something like that.
So what else can you tell about this bird just from looking at it?
This is a little difficult with this one because it's so wet, but normally what we would do is we'd look at its feathers, and because they molt in a certain sequence over a number of years, we can then estimate the age of the bird from the plumage. And looking at this one, this is a juvenile because of some of the markings on the wings. They've got these strong bands which only come through when they're more than a year old, but not to the extent that it would be an adult.
So you're going to take a sample. How do you go about doing that, and how much do you need?
We open up the bird, so we expose the soft tissues, and then we'll take those, and we take as much as possible of the liver. So we'll take the whole liver, the whole kidney. We then take around about 50 grams of the muscle. Unfortunately, we won't be able to take the brain sample from this bird, but normally we would as well. And then we'll take off a bone sample, which we then clean up, ready for our archive.
So how many chemicals are you looking for?
From one liver, we can look for hundreds of chemicals. And that's what we're aiming to do with the buzzards at the moment. What we're doing is a part of the 25-year environment plan monitoring, we're looking to establish baselines for this species, the buzzard, across a range of chemical classes. That includes toxic metals, biocides, and also those persistent bioaccumulative chemicals, those forever chemicals. And that includes some more legacy ones, like polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs, but also of particular interest at the moment are the PFAs.
So how do the chemicals actually get into these birds?
For the predatory birds, it's predominantly through their diet. But how does it get into their diet? That's a good question. And so the chemicals are released accidentally into the environment through wastewaters from production or from sewage works as well. And then for the terrestrial environment, sewage sludge can be then put onto the land to fertilise it. It's a valuable resource in that respect. But that's also a source of those chemicals into the terrestrial environment. Similar for the aquatic environment, but rather than the solids that come from sewage works, it's the water effluent going out into the streams.
And this is why birds of prey are so useful, because they eat small mammals. You really can see, I'm assuming, the sort of chain of chemicals.
Yeah, so once it's in the environment, those chemicals will be absorbed by plants and soil organisms, such as earthworms, things like that. Then they're fed upon by the small mammals, and then the small mammals are eaten by the predatory birds. And so you've got several levels going up the trophic food chain. And for chemicals like PFAS, what they tend to do is biomagnify through that food chain. So the concentrations you find at each subsequent level increases.
Looking at this bird, you said you think it's been scavenged, and I suppose that's another thing to bear in mind with these contaminants, is that they can enter the food chain and then re-enter the food chain through organisms like that.
That's correct, and particularly for the forever chemicals, so those persistent chemicals, because they won't break down over the lifetime of a bird, but then as the bird is either scavenged upon or it decomposes, and then the contaminants are released back into the environment, and then that can be then absorbed by another organism.
Obviously, in this case, the bird was involved in some form of accident, but can you tell if a bird has actually died from an overdose of chemicals?
For many of the chemicals that we study, it's not that clear from the post-mortem examination that it's died from that chemical. It's not showing signs that we could use to diagnose that. For some chemicals, like rodenticides, rat poison, that is clear, because we see hemorrhaging in the bird that's indicative that it's been poisoned by those rodenticides. And then with the analysis, we can confirm that they've been exposed to that chemical.
So it's a bit like a detective story.
Yeah, for the birds, we can bring together the observations from the post-mortem, the circumstances in which the bird was found, and then critically the concentrations of those chemicals in their tissues.
What are your results actually finding at the moment? Are you finding that certain birds in particular have got more chemicals than others, or that there's been a general trend up or down, or is it consistent across species?
Within species, we find that older birds tend to have more of the PFAS in them than younger birds. That's because it bioaccumulates, so the more the bird eats, the more it retains in its body. Across species, we're still investigating that, really. I know for similar chemicals, brominated flame retardants, what we've seen is we saw both in species that fed predominantly on an aquatic environment and on those that fed on a terrestrial environment, we've seen a similar increase in the late 80s through the 90s into the 2000s. But then with the aquatic species, we've seen a decline, whereas with the terrestrial species, it's levelled off rather than declined. So that's an interesting difference between those two habitats.
And this is why getting a spectrum of species is so important, because then you can look across different environments and that will tell you where the chemicals are coming from. Is that right?
Using species that represent different food chains and different habitats will allow us to identify the best sentinel for that particular chemical, and that will be determined by its fate within the wider environment.
Now, you mentioned fish earlier. Do we know that these chemicals are having the same effect on marine organisms as they are on your birds?
They're certainly accumulating at similar rates in the aquatic environments in fish and in their predators as well.
So obviously if they're in the fish and the birds are eating the fish and we're seeing these forever chemicals in them, humans eat fish as well. So does that mean that similar effects are likely to be happening within us?
Yeah, we're certainly likely to be seeing accumulation of PFAs in us, as we see in the buzzards and the birds. We have a phrase, One Health, that's there to remind us that we do share an environment, and so if we pollute that environment for the birds, we're also polluting it for ourselves.
In that case, why are forever chemicals so worrying for humans?
We're long-lived, so we've got more opportunity to accumulate those forever chemicals. That means that we're likely to accumulate higher levels, and that may well reach levels that could have a detrimental effect on our health.
What we should do in the meantime is exactly what you're doing, which is keep monitoring them so that we know exactly what levels these chemicals are. And then if there's a sort of flashpoint or it gets worse, then take action.
Yeah, I'm not talking for the government, but they are taking action in terms of trying to reduce releases to the environment. And the monitoring that we carry out is part of the metrics, the measures that they use to determine whether they're having the effect they want in reducing exposure. So it's keeping an eye on what's happening in the birds and using that to help inform us about what's happening in the wider environment. We're going to go into the analytical labs in which we measure the levels of contaminants that we've confined in the tissues.
Now, this does look like a scientist's lab, doesn't it? So there's some weird and wonderful glass flasks and tubes behind a glass cabinet here. It looks wonderful, doesn't it?
It does, with the bubbling liquid, yes, off a spiral tube.
So what we've got here inside the fume cupboards is a set of sock slit extractors. In each of these extractors, which is sort of a bulb flask connected to a condensing column, so lots of spirals of glass that allows the solvent that's being heated up in the bulb to go up into these columns, and then it condenses and comes back down again. So what this is doing is concentrating the sample which we've extracted from the tissue, so then we can detect the contaminants in that sample.
Would all your samples be potentially put through a device like this?
Yes, for most of the sort of persistent chemicals that are thermally stable, so they're not broken down by heat, we'd use these sort of extraction techniques to take those chemicals out of a very complex type of sample, like a liver, and put it into a simpler solvent-based sample that we can then use in our analysis.
What samples have you got in these tubes?
Well, these are buzzard liver samples in here. We're preparing these samples for analysis of another forever chemical, brominated flame retardants. And these will be from the same buzzards that we'll then also use to analyse further PFAs as well.
How would a flame retardant chemical get inside a buzzard?
It's very similar to the process as what we talked about for the perfluorinated alkyl substances as well, those PFAs. They're used in industrial contaminants, they're used in domestic appliances because they have uses. They reduce the likelihood of fires from electrical equipment, things like that. They've been found in house dust, and so then when you collect the house dust and you dispose of that, that's a release into the environment.
But that just goes to show that regulating these chemicals is quite difficult because they are so important and can save lives.
Exactly. It's a balancing act between the benefits of a chemical and the likely environmental risk.
So once you've finished collecting these samples from these wonderful bubbling flasks, what do you do next?
We take these samples and we introduce them to the analytical machines that we have next door. They're the real sort of Batman machines. You know, you put a small sample in and they tell you a lot about it, all the different types of chemicals that are in there.
And when you get the results, are you ever surprised? Do you get 10, 20 chemicals in one bird, or do you get hundreds?
Depending which machine you're looking at, most of the ones we use now, they have a broad spectra, so they can look at many chemicals at the same time. So we're talking dozens, if not hundreds.
Lee Walker there, wrapping up our tour of the Predatory Bird Monitoring Scheme at UKCH in Lancaster. And thank you, Lee, for taking time off from such vital work to show us all the steps involved in understanding just how common and pervasive these chemicals are in our environment.
And can I just flag up that as UKCH is a charity, we secure funding for these invaluable programmes from a variety of sources, and that includes public donations. So if anyone would like to contribute to the funding of the work of the Predatory Bird Monitoring Scheme, you can do so through its Just Giving page, and we will put a link to that in the episode description.
What really struck me, though, when Lee was explaining what they look for during the autopsy was the parallel between the birds of prey and humans, because we're also at the top of the food chain, or a food chain. And as he said, the accumulation that they're seeing is likely to be happening in humans as well, which is more than worrying.
Especially, as I mentioned at the top of the programme, with the list of all those substances and everyday items where these forever chemicals are actually located. And it's not surprising, with a potential 1,000-year lifespan, that these could have a gradual build-up and effect in our bodies. And there just isn't enough known yet. How do these chemicals affect different species? How do they change across different environments? Which species are most sensitive to them? So many questions, and this leads to gaps in regulations. So it's vital that work like this gets done so that we know exactly what we're dealing with.
Absolutely. And it was great to see how they piece this detective story together. But something Lee said right at the end there really sticks with me, that dozens, if not hundreds, of chemicals can be found in one bird. And I thought that was a shocking fact.
It shocked me as well. And I think because these chemicals in some ways are sort of invisible to us, we wash them down the drain or throw them away without really thinking about where they go. Understanding that they do stay in the environment and travel through the environment really just highlights how little we know about this. And when we use household chemicals in a domestic setting, we just don't think about it. And it's really made me think, at least, about the journey of where these things go after we throw them away.
Indeed. The Environment Agency, DEFRA, the Health and Safety Executive, are actively looking at potential regulation, using not only data from the UK, like Lee's, but also research from Europe and America, because, of course, this is a global issue. But while it might seem like the obvious solution is to completely ban all these chemicals, it isn't that black and white. A good example is their use in firefighting foams. The fluorinated substances they contain make them highly effective at putting out fires, particularly at airports or chemical fires. But that, of course, means there is then an extensive release of such chemicals directly into the environment. The Health and Safety Executive is currently reviewing the risks to the environment and human health from these chemicals in firefighting foams, with a view to restricting their use in Great Britain. But one of the things that will need to be weighed up is if they should remain available for limited use with certain types of industries, certain types of fires, where the risk is greater if such fires can't be extinguished quickly and effectively, if there should be trade-offs, basically, for essential uses.
I think that there are lessons to be learned here for the future introduction of chemicals as well. Even if chemicals in this family do get banned, quantities from past use still linger in the environment, and we will be dealing with the impact of this family of chemicals for a long, long time. Going forward, we need to understand better the implications of such substances over their lifespan before they are released into the environment. On the plus side, the methods and tests used to assess the risks of new chemicals are constantly improving, and the industry is moving towards a future where chemicals are developed to be safe and sustainable by design, with risks being considered upfront, something UKCEH has been collaborating with EU partners on in recent years.
For those still widely in use in this area, it's going to be a challenge to phase them out. But in the meantime, manufacturers can play their part to self-regulate. Some outdoor clothing and cosmetic manufacturers are making strides to phase their use out. You can get saucepans, for instance, that say they don't have PFOAs in them. And the public can play a role and try to choose those products without these chemicals in them. But we need better labelling. One look at the back of a bottle on most household products and you just get tiny writing, which is very hard to see and hard to comprehend ingredients as well.
Plenty of room for improvement on all levels. Thank you so much for listening to our latest episode of the Counting the Earth podcast. And please do join us next time when we take another look at nature through numbers.